There's no debate. He speaks and it's over. He pronounces judgment over them and there's no rebuttal. There's nothing to argue about. He is the authoritative voice. And they are religious leaders, so they have a sense of their own divine service. But in this case, by claiming divine service and using the public speech, he completely shuts them down. So for the sake of the narrative, like for the sake of Matthew, as you're reading it, he now has the moral authority. He has been able to define the terms. When I was in high school, I did Lincoln-Douglas debate, and the very first thing we had to do was to do the definitions. And if you could define the terms of the debate, you probably would win, because you got to say what this actually meant. So John comes out, he defines his terms, he wins. So from here on out, everything is measured against what John thinks, rather than what these people think. So we then, as readers, become sympathetic, and we understand that John's criteria is the one that matters. Okay? All right. We could go a lot of different directions there, but I want to move to the baptism. So this photo, I am standing in Jordan at the baptismal site, and I am taking a picture across onto the Israeli side, taking a picture of the baptismal site of Jesus. Maybe some of you have been there. Yeah.
Is the water really clean and it just shows up dirty in this photo?
No, it's dirty.
How dirty is it for most of the people that get baptized? How dirty is the water?
I don't know. Like, I got into it. It didn't bother me enough to not.
But they'll sell. It's visibly dirty.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But they'll sell you a robe and let you go through a fancy shower and...
They have a number of, like in American parks, they would be like these places you could get together with family with picnic tables, covered but not sides. And they have a bunch of those. And so as we came up, there were people from all over the world having worship service, singing in whatever language was their heart language, preparing to baptize people. And then they would walk down in whatever way they wanted to, wearing whatever was their tradition, and then they would be baptized. We did a remembrance of baptism in the river. We don't rebaptize. I'm pretty sure we still don't do that. But it's a pretty amazing place, and people seem to not care. They just jump in. Mm-hmm. But as my husband would remind you, don't go very far because there are snipers, and that's like an international boundary. You don't cross that because you'll get in trouble really fast. So you can't like go from Israel to Jordan back. You have to go all the way around. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is the same text. This is the same prayer. We're just moving through the whole thing. Verse 13, then Jesus came from Galilee to John at the Jordan to be baptized by him. John would have prevented him, saying, I need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me? But Jesus answered him, let it be so now, for it is proper for us in this way to fulfill all righteousness. Then he consented. And when Jesus had been baptized, just as he came up from the water, suddenly the heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, this is my son, the beloved, with whom I am well pleased. So let's just, as a group, talk through here. We have, I don't see much about wealth, but I see stuff about divine service and about control, dominating control. What do you see? Jesus is allowing John to control.
That's an interpretation.
So I think it's right. So then who's still in control?
Jesus.
Yeah. This is a moment of tension in the gospel about who is the authority, what's happening. Because so far, Matthew has set up John now as the moral authority, which is very interesting. But then we still have to meet Jesus. So this is us meeting Jesus. We've already seen the birth narrative, but this is us meeting Jesus as an adult going into his ministry. And so they've sort of set up John as this divine servant who has incredible sort of soft power, right? He's able to control groups of people. And then Jesus comes to him, and John is immediately deferential. It's the opposite of when the Pharisees and Sadducees came. Now he's completely deferential. And he says, wait, no, this isn't right. You're supposed to be the one to baptize me. So in terms of the narrative, the way the narrative goes, they've just taken the authority and brought him down a notch and put somebody else up there. And that's an interesting move to make. But Jesus says it has to be this way. So there's something about John that's important in order for Jesus to become who he's supposed to be.
It reminds me of what you said yesterday when it was like, do you want the vengeance of the Roman Empire defeating people who look strong or defeating people who look weak?
Yes.
If you already said John up as strong, then Jesus is like way up there.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So if you have John the prophet, John the forerunner, John the moral authority, and then he immediately is submissive to Jesus, you don't even have to explain who Jesus is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like the one where they have the guy underneath and he's really strong. They've got their hands on his head, but at the same time he's still quite strong. So it proves something about him right away.
And why would John be willing to do that? Because don't they always just want to be at the top?
That's interesting. Well, this is the thing. When you're talking about hegemonic masculinity, there's only ever one winner. Okay, well, that's like an interesting movie, but that's not real life. You know, millions of men have to exist in the world and never being emperor. But how do you cope? How do you live your lives? This is part of the thing of actually dealing with real figures. They're not real people in the sense that we meet them. But in the narrative, they're real people, part of our faith tradition, and real people who are part of the body of Christ. Mm-hmm. And I've wondered this actually about Agrippa, who's like the second in command to Augustus, who was in that photo that we saw yesterday from the Areopagus. That guy never got to be in charge, but he had a really great life. And he had a lot of money, and he had a lot of control, and he built a lot of buildings. So how do you, you know, what are people's choices in front of them? Mm-hmm. Okay. The purpose of the end of the text here is to establish who Jesus is. And so by the end of the text, by the end of this old brick view that we moved through, we go from John proclaiming, repent, to this is the one. The voice from heaven, the divine voice actually comes and identifies who the servant is, the divine servant. So from here on out, there will be some tension between John and Jesus for the next couple of chapters. Remember, there's this interaction that takes place with John's disciples who come. Because John has a following, and then Jesus is building a following. And so I think there still is kind of remnants of this dominating control where you have to resolve the tension in favor of Jesus so that we're clear on who's on top. For all of its resistance, I think the gospel still has, you know, we have to have one hero. All right. This is that text I was talking about. We can move through this pretty quickly. There's one small and kind of fun point I want to make before we get to the big text. When John heard in prison what the Messiah was doing, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another?" Jesus answered them, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. And blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me." So when John asks for proof of what is happening, Jesus appeals to works that affect other people's bodies. Interesting. It's liberating in every case, but it's still stuff that has been done to other people's bodies in order to make them live their lives improved. Interesting. And then I just can't help it. Okay, so as they went away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about John. "What did you go out in the wilderness to look at? A reed shaken in the wind? What then did you go out to see? Someone dressed in soft robes? Look, those who wear soft robes are in royal palaces. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, 'See, I am sending my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare your way before you.' Truly, I tell you, among those born of women, no one has arisen greater than John the Baptist. Yet, the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John came. And if you're willing to accept it, he is Elijah who is to come. Let anyone with ears listen." So the photos that I have here are the depictions of Herod Antipas from Jesus Christ Superstar. The one on the right is can we call this like a traditional film now? I guess maybe classic film? And the one on the left is from the TV version of Jesus Christ Superstar that was last spring. Anybody know who this is?
Alice Cooper?
Yeah. Alice Cooper's a Lutheran, yeah?
Oh!
Yeah. When I was in college, we did a homestay choir tour, and people ended up staying with Alice Cooper. they had some stories. It was kind of fun. So I just couldn't resist putting them in here. Well, why do I have pictures of Herod Antipas here. I have pictures because when Jesus asks these questions, it's rhetorical. If you're talking in Galilee about who are the people dressed in soft robes, I mean, just look at the way that they're depicted. They are the ones, Herod and his court, the elites in that area, they're the ones that are putting on the display in the show. They're the ones who have the clothing that matters. They're the ones that have the wealth that can dominate and make people do things. And Herod Antipas, not for nothing, I mean, he was Herod the Great's son. So he did have a little bit of an inferiority problem. So he built himself a couple of cities following his father's footsteps in order to make him seem just as much a man, right? Just as much a leader. So Sepphoris, the place that's near Nazareth, about 5K away, you see that's a Roman city laid out, and it's expensive, and it was new money. And that was the way that Herod was showing himself off in that area. It's kind of strange because in the middle of nowhere, all of a sudden you have this big Roman city. He had to have one. Dad had one. And he also had his own, he wanted to build a city by the Sea of Galilee because he had to have something on the water because his dad had something on the water. And he called it Tiberias after the emperor, his boss. So he very much is playing this game. And so Jesus says to them, did you come out here to see Herod, that kind of guy? No, there's no way. And this is interesting because he is, without saying it, he's rejecting Herod as any kind of form of leader or moral authority, right? He's emasculating him. He's taking away the things that would build up Herod's masculinity. So I think it's really interesting that in our 20th and 21st century adaptations, we play with masculinity and gender with these characters too. It's interesting to me. Because there's always been this idea of Herod Antipas as whether or not he is strong or weak. Is he strong or weak? By all accounts, he is supposed to be the strong guy. He's supposed to be the one who has all the wealth, all the dominating power. And yet, the figures in the gospel they're laughing at him. They're thumbing their noses at him. They're doing whatever in order to resist him. The phrase sometimes, people have different interpretations, but the reed shaken by the wind, on the one hand, it has this sense of being weak. On the other, what does a reed, when wind blows through it, do?
Rattles.
It makes a lot of noise. It's totally empty. Right? There's no substance to it. The man is it loud. So both things may be true at the same time of that kind of phrase. So interesting call out then of what we would consider to be ideal masculinity in favor of John. And then again, phrased around John's divine service as the prophet. All right, so this juxtaposition is set up. Yeah.
I don't know if we have time, but the phrase that he must have in the separate ballots and the Bible taken by force, it's, I mean, based on what we're talking about, that seems very interesting.
The piece about violence?
Yeah, the kingdom is having a separate violence.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting in a number of different ways. What?
Just that, you know, it seems like God is like the all-powerful, so how is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
That it's separate violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That in the realm of the world, the kingdom of heaven can suffer violence. And then, you know, we go back to this idea of empire and the empire of God being different from the empire of Rome, that it is not impenetrable. The kingdom of heaven, in fact, is not impenetrable. Mm-hmm. It can suffer violence. It can be diminished. And that violence is a bad thing, right? It suffers violence. And so the question is, is the kingdom of heaven not going to traffic in violence? Because that's what the empire does. You set that up maybe as a separate thing. Yeah, we could spend all day on these.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a contradiction in verse 11.
Yes.
Truly I tell you, among those born of women, no one has risen greater than John the Baptist, yet the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. So he's both at the top and the bottom.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really something. This is Jesus defending John.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's defending John. And do you have anybody who's, I mean, especially in the ancient world, the idea, among those born of women, Jesus might as well say, among everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There isn't anybody who's not born a woman. So he is the most important. He's the best. And yet, in the kingdom of heaven, he's at the bottom. So it's I wonder if somehow Jesus, in the middle of his arguing back, realized, that's not actually what I mean to say. I don't know. It's a very interesting thing. Okay, so here and then over here.
It seems like This and the last slide, the verse 6, is like this precursor to the Beatitudes almost. Like Jesus is starting mm-hmm. to talk about the kingdom of heaven mm-hmm.
yep.
in such a way of like, look, everything's upside down. Mm-hmm. Like, starting with him saying, like, in order for me to claim power in this situation, I'm actually subjugating myself. You're going to baptize me.
Yeah.
And by making you the one who's giving me that power, then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the same with, you know, the taking the kingdom of heaven by force versus those who do not use force mm-hmm. will be the ones to claim the kingdom of heaven.
And so there's the narrative blocks of Matthew and the teaching blocks of Matthew. So between the baptism and this kind of stuff, we have the Sermon on the Mount. So we have the Beatitudes, we have the teachings of Jesus. So that idea has already been introduced. Mm-hmm. So it's harkening back to that same reversal thing. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say that the born of woman thing might be referring to baptism as rebirth. And I mean, you know, the connection there that once you're born of the Spirit, yeah, it's something better than being born of this woman.
Well, that's interesting.
Or it could just, isn't it? I always thought it was just Jesus saying, everyone except me.
Uh-huh. Maybe, except he actually was born of woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fact that Jesus is the one speaking it, though, he does reserve a certain authority because he's the one who gets to say. So I think your point stands. You guys are extremely bright. This is so much fun. This is, To have people this interested in the thing that occupied you for so long. Cool. All right, I don't want to finish this time without getting to Matthew 14. So
yeah.
Can we go? All right, at that time, so we've jumped from Matthew 11 to Matthew 14. At that time, Herod the ruler heard reports about Jesus, and he said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead, and for this reason, these powers are at work in him. For Herod had arrested John, bound him, and put him in prison on account of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had been telling him, 'It is not lawful for you to have her.' Though Herod wanted to put him to death, he feared the crowd, because they regarded him as a prophet. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before the company, and she pleased Herod so much that he promised an oath to grant her whatever she might ask. Prompted by her mother, she said, 'Give me the head of John the Baptist here on a platter.' The king was grieved. Yet out of his regard for his oaths and for the guests, he commanded to be given. He sent and had John beheaded in the prison. The head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, who brought it to her mother. His disciples came and took the body and buried it. Then they went and told Jesus." Okay. Dominating control over self and others is the dominant thing here. But I don't want to let the wealth thing go by. So I'll just say something quick about that before we go into the dominating control piece. So Herod, having these banquets, right, is a display of wealth and power. Having people who are your guests, where you provide entertainment, where you provide food, where you provide the home, right, the place to celebrate, that's a statement of authority, masculine authority. So that's the context for which this whole thing takes place, the actual event. I just want to say that. Except, nothing goes away as a Christian. So, dominating control over self and others. Would you like a minute to talk to your partners to sort of get your thoughts together?
No.
Nope? Okay, let's go.
I just have a question. Why is he saying this to his servants? Like, why is he telling his servants this? Why isn't he telling, like, is the idea that, I don't know, like, what gives the servants the right to question what's going on, that he has to explain it to them? I don't know, it just seems weird that he's telling his servants about what he thinks.
At the beginning?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
I mean, maybe the idea is that he's talking to the servants, which would have been the common people that would have gone to see John, so they were the ones that were concerned about who John was or who Jesus was,
mm-hmm.
whereas maybe Herod's people all sort of on the same level as him may not have cared as much. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because it shows out of the gate that Herod is not decisive and doesn't, like, there's a crack in the veneer, like, almost immediately. Because he's afraid that this is John the Baptist. Yeah.
I always thought the servants were almost like
the therapist. They're the people who aren't going to challenge your status.
Yes. Boy, isn't there some security in being the vice of something, right? And not being the guy in charge or the woman in charge, because you have the you're sort of protected, and yet you can give counsel. Yeah, so maybe there's something about that there, that there's these are trusted people. I do need to say, servants come in all economic strata in this kind of ancient world piece. This is not based on race, it's not based on ethnicity, and not all of them are poor. Some of them had amassed quite a bit of wealth, actually, and then were able to, you know, purchase their own freedom or whatever. Like, it's not the same kind of system as what we were talking about.
He's trying to work it out before he has the total authority to go to the top.
Mm-hmm.
He's confused and...
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that, well, we'll talk about this more at the end, but so he hears Jesus, John is already dead, and he thinks John is powerful enough to have come back to life. That says something. Like, he thinks this person that he's already had executed could come back from the dead. So he's unsettled. This isn't what he is hoping for. And what has the narrative already taught us about John and Jesus? Jesus is more powerful than John. And in this case, John has not come back from the dead, but guess who will?
Mm-hmm.
So this is like a little, gives you this image of, did John come back from the dead? Well, it turns out, no. But Jesus is more powerful. So Jesus eventually will. Yeah.
So would the servants have all been men?
It doesn't tell us what kind of servants they are. If there are sort of administrative retainer servants that are around Herod, yeah. I mean, if there are people bringing food in and out, it could have been multiple options.
Seems like they might be in the prison. I don't know.
I don't know. It's just hard to say. I think it's a compelling argument to say they would have been kind of his regular people who were around him on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. You're true Bible scholars. You're in the very first verse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, what else do you see? What about this business? I'll just ask you. What about this business about the oath? And he gives the daughter an oath. And then, in verse 9, out of regard for his oath and for the guests, he commanded it to be given.
So it's interesting. It's almost, this is putting Herod down even more because... Mm-hmm. Not only is there that crack in the veneer you talked about before, but the power really here is being grabbed in a masculine way by Herodias.
Yeah.
And she's using not only Herod, she's using somebody to use Herod to bring her John the Baptist's head.
Mm-hmm.
So she's like, there's multiple levels of control that she's exerting over the situation. Like, you talk about that performative masculinity. Like, she's the man.
She is exploiting the rules of the game, which Herod is following, in order to gain power over the situation. Because remember, she's the problem to begin with. The fact that he married her is the problem. So she has to do something. And so this is how she exerts her authority. And she does so in a masculine way by taking control over someone's body, first Herod's and then John's. Yeah, she's the one who is exerting this sort of thing.
And her daughter's.
And her daughter's.
She sends her daughter to dance,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know what...
So the daughter's body, right, is being used and put on display by the mother who is exerting masculine behaviors. It all gets very complicated. But as you know, in your lives, it is too. This isn't new. That's just, we don't normally read the Bible like this. Yeah.
But they're telling Herod to do something he wanted to do anyway, because it says he wanted to kill him, put him to death.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not asking for something outside of what Herod already wanted.
Right, which makes the beginning of that verse 9 so interesting. What do you make of that, where he says, and the king was grieved?
Mm-hmm.
He wants to kill John, but he's grieved about being sort of put in that position of needing to do it now.
I don't understand literature well enough, but I think it feels like we've moved from drama to tragedy. That there are no winners here. And that this, Matthew tells this story with a lot of detail, you know, because the death of John really is among the saddest things that appear in the gospel.
Yes, yes. And so this is a story that deserves a lot of attention. And so the death of John, that's interesting you say, but there are no winners in the story. I think that's an interesting thing to think about. What does it mean to win in this kind of story? What does it mean to win in an unwinnable situation? How do you define that? And then, so then who would be on the other side of that? Yeah, that's a very interesting question.
It's also just interesting, that idea of the oath. Mm-hmm. That oath, as someone who has power, if I say I'm going to do this, I can do this, and I will do this. And that's a very masculine idea. Mm-hmm. And so there, his masculinity, that idea of masculinity is being used against him.
Against him, yes. There's a scholar named James Scott who writes a book called Domination and the Arts of Resistance. It's one that scholars use a lot in Empire. And he tells the story about a colonial English man in Africa. And the situation is that the people come to him and say, we have a rabid elephant, you have to take it, you have to kill him. So he goes out with all of his people around him, and everybody's watching, and they go out, and the elephant is in fact quite sane. But they say, the elephant is dangerous and rabid, and you must kill him. So now the guy is completely trapped and has to make a decision. You kill the elephant or you not kill the elephant. And that's the situation that people, like this kind of hegemonic masculinity, this world of power sort of puts people in these impossible situations. He ends up killing the elephant because he has to in order to maintain his position of dominance. Mm-hmm. And his parents in the same kind of position. Yeah. I kind of did a whole paper about this at a scholarly conference. And he's in the same position. He's given his promise. And by giving a promise, he's made himself vulnerable. I think that's so interesting, especially when we think about God. God makes a promise. It makes God vulnerable. Yeah.
There was the interaction between John the Baptist and Herod. What kind of a relationship did they have? Was it totally antagonistic, or were they exchanging ideas about faith and such?
I think if you look realistically at history, not much of a relationship between the two. I think it was more, there's that guy standing out there, and he keeps talking about me, and he needs to shut up, because basically when Herod married Herodias, it wasn't just like a moral problem, it was the end of his kingdom, because the Nabataean dad, who he'd married the Nabataean princess, got mad at him for having dumped his daughter, so then they went to war. So Herod had to go back to Rome and ask for help. So then they had to send a legion to come and fight this thing out. So he had a bigger fish to fry. Like, this was a major problem that he had on his hands with this marriage. So to have one guy standing out there screaming and talking about how this was a bad idea and God was mad at him, it's like, stop. I need to focus on what I'm actually doing.
Just lock him up.
Yeah, just lock him up so he can be quiet. Mm-hmm.
Back to verse 5.
Yep.
I mean, Herod feared the crowd.
Yes.
So there is an element within him that's going to be submissive to the crowd, mm-hmm. based upon his fear of the crowd, because they regarded him as a prophet. So it creates this larger picture of the prophet always being against the emperor, mm-hmm. In one way or another.
And so John has established who he is, and he has the respect and regard of people, and he has certain authority. And so Herod is afraid of that authority. And in the ancient world, fear is not an emotion that lends to masculinity or masculine status. You don't show fear because fear compromises you. It makes you vulnerable. It makes your body vulnerable because you've succumbed to this emotion. You overcome it. Yeah, we haven't even talked about emotions and that kind of stuff yet, but that's all wrapped up in this too.
This is also like a foreshadowing of Pilate and Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Say a little bit more about that, because I think you're right.
Well, afraid of the crowd.
Yeah.
Awkward, not sure, kind of want to, but I don't know, I'm afraid of the crowd, worried about what people will think about him, but mm-hmm. backed into a corner.
So the people who are supposed to have the authority are in fact quite compromised. Mm-hmm. And they're not consistent, and they have character flaws.
They're good politicians.
Politicians, yeah. And part of it is because they're the leaders, their stuff gets exposed. Because they're always on display. People are always looking. This is so much fun. Yeah.
Well, I'm back to the king was grieved. And I think he's grieving for himself, not John. Mm-hmm. He's grieving because he is stuck and scared and anxious.
So maybe he knows he's not going to win this thing.
Yeah.
And so he's grieved because he understands, oh, this is not going to go well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's another, like, how that word grief is translated from the Greek. Like, is there another definition that maybe would mean something a little bit different to us? Like, frustrated or like
angry,
mm-hmm. something like that. Where yeah, it's as somebody mentioned, he wants to put Harry to death, but it sounds like he really wants to do it in a really not at all public,
yes.
hidden way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is putting him on blast and saying like, you have to do it right now, and all
in front of all these people
are all witnesses. For mm-hmm. this.
And you're doing it because these women are telling you to. This is not the way he wanted this to go.
Yeah.
If he was going to put him to death, it needed to be quiet. Nobody needed to notice.
The NIV translates it distress.
Stress, distress.
Stress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't remember which verb this is. I'd have to go look at it. But I do think that, yeah, that's a bigger semantic field than just sad. And this is interesting because this isn't the last time we hear about John in the gospel. That after he dies, his witness continues. And so it's like, strike me down and I shall become more powerful than you can possibly be. I only make Star Wars references. That's it. That's all I got. I had kids at a certain age and I stopped watching movies. No, but there is a sense of, because when someone dies in a heroic way, then they become more influential. The story takes on a larger role. And so even though Jesus is the most important male in the story, John's witness ends up being very important. I mean, the last thing that you see here, his disciples came and took the body. It took me a while to figure out that that meant there was no head, right? Like, they take the headless body and they go and they bury it somewhere. So, I mean, John's death is not like a noble soldier. I mean, he is whoosh, cut off and is a woman who ends up cutting off his head. And even in the ancient world, that meant something. Yeah, he's emasculated. So I'm not saying that John, like, claims masculinity in his death. But I'm saying he isn't completely emasculated either, because people take care of his body, and even though it's penetrated and it's violated and he's killed, after that his witness stays as a part of things. Jesus continues to talk about him.
Kendra?
Yeah?
I'm up here.
Oh, hi!
Well, you're on that detail. Could you just comment about the grotesque character of his head on a platter?
Yeah.
I mean, what makes carrying that into a party?
Yep. At all okay?
Well, what is it?
Mm-hmm.
Both as that it's requested, A, and then B, that it's followed through.
Yeah. I think part of it is to call Herod's bluff to say, we want you to do this, but we got to see it. You can't just send the guy down there and come back and, you know, bring back his belt or something and say, he's dead, how do we know? And I do think there's a gender element here, and a lot of feminist scholars have done a lot of really great work with this text and saying that there's a power play that's made here over John. If John is going to question her, then she's going to take that away. And let's go back. How does John gain his power? His voice.
Mm-hmm.
His speaking. So if you cut the head off, there's no more of that. Just shut up now. You know, he's not going to talk anymore. So I think there's different pieces moving around there. I think there's a sexual piece. I think there's a public speech piece. I think there's a you got to prove that he's dead piece. On the platter thing, I don't know, is that just dramatic flair? You know, some people have talked about the grotesque symbolism, like the opposite between like the body of Jesus offered up for the world and then the body of the head of John offered up for the empire.
Seven.
But there's a contrast there. So I think there's multiple ways to read that. Anything else you'd add?
No, thanks.
It's just wild.
The movie Seven.
What thing that came to mind with the comment of the foreshadowing of Pilate?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm correct, Jesus Barabbas was a bit of a violent revolutionary, a very masculine figure,
mm-hmm.
right? And the crowd was convinced to call for this very masculine figure's release instead of Jesus' release. And this time, in this case, the oath is used as a linchpin to secure John's death. So in both cases, we have masculinity being used in order to bring about the death of a very important figure in the mm-hmm. gospel.
Yeah.
And is that, a critique of masculinity and its volatility and its...
This perceived instability that I talked about yesterday, yeah, because anything that's seen as a threat to masculinity, whether that's powerful women or just men who aren't, but are acting as though they are, that there's this threat to masculinity, so therefore it has to be shored up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done so in a violent way. I won't steal that idea. You should write that paper. I promise. I won't steal it. It's a great idea. It's a great talk about to the intertextuality of comparing the two. Yeah. Matthew's very good at giving us these glimpses so that by the time we get to the thing, we know what it means. Because he's already told us several stories back.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a sense that maybe Herod is becoming human in this, that he's not this big authority top dog anymore, that we're getting a sense he has a conscience because he likes John, or he's grieved over John?
Mark is the one who talks about him liking to listen to John. So if you're including that into the story, absolutely.
Yeah.
If you're just kind of counting yourself to Matthew, then I don't know that you can make as strong of a case there. But the point of what you're making was very true. That the whole thing of who is the one who's supposed to have the power of life and death? The hegemonic man, the emperor, that's the one who's supposed to have power over life and death. When we get introduced to Herod Antipas, he's immediately afraid that John the Baptist has come back from the dead. So he doesn't have that power over life and death. Presumably something else does, something that's directing John.
Do you think that's more the author's intent? Because I remember Herod as a historical figure, kills family members and other people. I'm having a hard time reconciling what I know is kind of historically told about Herod versus this guy.
Yes. Yeah, we don't. There's no actual historical evidence that this scene ever happened. But it's very important in the Gospel of Matthew to develop both of those characters, so both John and Herod. So you're absolutely right. I mean, there's some conflict here for the things that the New Testament says from what we would know historically. But that being said, we don't know that it didn't, because there's no record of anything like that. But what you're saying is, yeah, there's a narrative thread here, and there's a purpose for telling the story the way it's told. Now, both Mark and Matthew do this, so presumably there was a tradition that predated them that they both took part in. But yeah, there's this, the trajectory is that our guys keep getting bigger, and their guys keep getting smaller, except our guys die. And then there has to be something after that, right? So that's where the resurrection story is, just breaks open the whole thing. Right, it's 5 after 5. I want to end by talking about what we've talked about today. You guys, you hit so many of these things. I understand John the Baptist's masculinity in terms of an alternative outsider, of redefining some of the terms that ancient masculinity uses. He doesn't get rid of them altogether. He redefines several of them, and he rejects others. That he understands separation from the community as control over self. Like, I'm going to go plant my flag out here, and y'all can come if you want to. But I'm not playing that game anymore. That he uses prophetic speech in order to create power. That between John and Jesus and the baptism, there is this tension of masculine power. That John retains some power, and yet it is Jesus who sort of wins that thing. That he loses his head, and whether or not that's emasculation or not is ambivalent. If in any other circumstance, you would never say that if somebody got their head cut off, that they somehow won. But if there's any winner in the story, it's almost John. Or at least the message that John proclaims, because it doesn't die with him. It keeps going. So the death strengthens him, not weakens him. He's mentioned in chapter 14 and in 21. Jesus says, none has arisen greater than this man. And he does have a role after his death, but it's a role that's controlled by others. He no longer speaks. Jesus speaks for him. So the thing that John does is no longer done. So that's sort of how I have described and talked about his masculinity in that chapter. And I think you guys hit all of the very interesting things, plus things I hadn't even considered yet. So thank you very much for your time.